Hey everyone, it's Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal, and this is the Fretboard Journal's 96th podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for subscribing to this podcast via iTunes. Please do if you haven't yet. And thank you so much for subscribing to the Fretboard Journal magazine itself at fretboardjournal.com. Our 35th issue is mailing right now. I know a lot of folks have already got their hands on it. In it, Danny Barnes, Marty Lanham of the Nashville Guitar Company, Cindy Cashjoller, Richard Thompson, Frank Wakefield. So many cool guitar and fretted instrument stories. So much cool guitar porn, for lack of a better word. I've got to give a shout out to our friends over at Hoffy Cases. Thanks to them, we have these brand new and beautiful cardboard mailers that every issue is going out in for our subscribers. So all the copies will show up at your doorstep intact, which is very cool. Gotta thank those guys. Today's podcast, we are talking to Josh Rosenthal of Tompkins Square Records. And for over 10 years now, he started his record label right around the time we started the Fretboard Journal. Josh has put out some of the coolest fretted instrument-based records we've ever heard. People talk about the glory days of Tacoma Records. They talk about Revenant. They talk about Matador Records. Josh, in his own little universe, has created so many cool recordings. He did the Imaginational Anthem series that turned so many people onto some of the modern day and, you know, formerly obscure and lost fingerstyle guys. He's put out the EC Ball reissue record. That's Wayne Henderson's mentor. Tim Buckley Records, Charlie Louvin's later records, Roland White records. Just so much cool stuff. And to celebrate his 10th anniversary, he did something incredibly cool, which is he commissioned a guitar to be built to commemorate his label, and now he's letting all sorts of great players try it out. We actually have a great video on our site at fretboardjournal.com of all of these incredible artists who have been on his label playing this guitar. Trevor Healy is the guy behind the guitar, the builder, and he's actually going to be featured in a forthcoming issue. Totally unrelated, but a cool coincidence. Before we get to our conversation with Josh, I do have a quick announcement. This is mid-February 2016. If by some odd chance you are listening to this and are also headed to Wintergrass 2016 over in Bellevue, Washington, by all means, go to the Regency stage on Saturday, February 27th at around 10 a.m. I'm going to be hosting another one of our vintage instrument shootouts. We've done this a few times now. This year, we've got Chris Eldridge and Mike Compton playing together for the very first time on a couple dozen very rare and very cool instruments that I am currently gathering for these guys. We have some, you know, classic Martins, some classic Gibsons, some pretty obscure things like a Lyon and Healy Lakeside Jumbo for Critter to play, some oddball mandolins for Mike Compton. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's always very informative. These two guys have never played together, and they certainly have never played all these instruments before, so it's going to be a magical and spontaneous kind of hour or two-hour long set. If you cannot be in Bellevue, obviously a lot of you cannot, we're going to be filming that, and we're going to be recording that, so that will either become a future Fretboard Journal video or a future Fretboard Journal podcast. Speaking of podcasts, our 100th podcast is just around the corner. By my estimate, it is going to be landing in your podcast feed in mid-March, and we have a very special episode lined up. It's actually the start of several episodes. It's a cool little mini-series that we will be doing. No, we're not solving any murders or anything, but we are going to have a fun little mini-series within the Fretboard Journal podcast family, and that'll be our 100th episode. So subscribe now, like I said, if you haven't yet. Without further ado, here's Josh Rosenthal of Tompkins Square Records. So, Josh, congratulations on 10 years of Tompkins Square.
Cheers. Thank you.
So we started our businesses, the Fretboard Journal and Tompkins Square, around the same time. And you guys have always had, you know, this incredible vision and this incredible array of releases. I'm curious what the original, you know, 10 years ago or 11 years ago, what was the original thought behind this label?
Well, I really was looking for something to do because I had worked at Sony for 15 years and felt I needed a change, and had some thoughts about putting together a guitar compilation, which was the first Imaginational Anthem record. And I sort of was doing that for fun on the side. And it was exciting because I got an unreleased Sandy Bull track on there through his widow, who was kind enough to provide that. And just the whole discovery of finding people like Max Oakes and Harry Tausig, who are sort of like first generation American primitive players. It was exhilarating to do the detective work, to try to find people. I really enjoyed that. And in 2005, it wasn't as easy as it is today. You know, trying to find Peter Walker in 2005 when there's a zillion Peter Walkers without Facebook. You know, that was challenging. And I enjoyed that part, and I enjoyed connecting with people who basically had been dormant for decades. And that was a really fun part of bringing people back, and in many cases, having them play their, you know, first tunes in decades as well.
I know you're a record collector, and you actually have a whole book out on that whole facet of your life, but you must be a guitarist as well to be gravitating towards this stuff, right?
I'm a terrible guitarist. I do have guitars, and I plunk around, but I have no real facility on the instrument.
Got it. I know how that goes. So what, you know, you had this list of guys that you had, you know, I'm assuming had either copies or the original LPs that they released. You know, what were they all still, you know, thinking of themselves as guitarists when you were able to track them down? Had some moved on?
Not really. I mean, Harry Tausig, his first album came out in 1965. And if you listen to it, it's so out there in certain ways. Like, nobody was really playing that kind of music back then. I mean, Fahey was coming on the scene with his own records, but it's very unusual to find like really spaced out loner, you know, acoustic guitar from that year or that era. So his record's very special, and it's a private press. It, you know, I mean, probably a couple of hundred copies. You know, I'm lucky enough to have one because he sent me one so I could make the record, because there's no master. But, you know, finding someone like him, he became a teacher. I mean, he actually did some instructional guitar books like in the 70s, but then he became a teacher, I think film and photography. And now his big thing is he photographs weird museums.
Okay.
So he'll go to like the Cockroach Hall of Fame or something like that. And he'll do this like all over the country and takes these road trips. And he's amassed this incredible collection of photographs of weird museums that somebody should really do a coffee table book or something, because it's just amazing. So yeah, they all have like different stories, and some of them have played throughout and some of them put down their instrument. So, you know, there's the whole gamut, you know, in between there.
Amazing. And were there any characters, are there any LPs or recordings you're holding onto where you just were never able to track down where these people were or where they ended up?
Actually, right now I'm in the middle of this fascinating project with these two guys who I'm basically partnering with, who are sort of collectors of solo guitar, private press stuff. And it's interesting because their sensibility is just like mine. Like, we're so connected. Like, it's about melody, and it's not necessarily about technique. It's more about the feel and the melody and the mood. And in most cases, and most of the songs that we're looking at, is like the mood is very dark. So that's kind of like the stuff we like. And they have found all this incredible material. And so now we're actually in the process right now of finding all the people and clearing all the tracks. And so we're starting to get some of these stories. And I'm telling you, there's incredible forgotten American primitive, if that's what you want to call it, solo guitar that I mean, I'd never heard of any of these people. You know, that's how rare a lot of this stuff is. So that's coming. That'll be the volume 8 of the Imaginational Anthem series.
That's amazing. I know what you mean about the the darker side of, I guess, fingerstyle or American primitive guitar, because there is sort of that, there's that pretty music, and then there's the Peter Lang and the Fahey and, you know, all that stuff. And you guys definitely have embraced that over the years.
I just have gravitated towards that aesthetic. It's personal for me. I mean, there's tons of guitarists and guitar music that people tell me I'm supposed to like. And I mean, I don't really want to name names, and I won't, but there, you know, for every one guitar player who I love, there's like 10 who I'm supposed to like, who I just don't connect with. And I think a lot of it is just like the soulfulness that comes through, or a, I don't know, it's a very particular thing, and you know it immediately when you hear it. And if you listen to some of the songs on Imaginational Anthem, or you listen to Michael Chapman, you know, who really gets under my skin, sure. You know, there's just certain guys who can do it. And it's something I really have a hard time explaining. It's just sort of a nuance and a feel that somebody projects in their playing.
Yeah. And who, you know, we keep hearing about how hard it is to run a record label, and you know, especially a label that, you know, isn't necessarily all about vinyl these days. What, you know, how, what's been the reception, you know, globally in terms of these releases? Do you kind of know exactly how many to produce before each release, or have you been surprised?
I would sort of say that at the moment, like, the business is very fragile. You have multiple formats that are in distress in one way or another. Like, vinyl is doing really well. However, it's a low margin product. It's expensive to make. And unless you're like an indie band that's going to sell like 10,000 right out the door, and it's, you know, your Modest Mouse or somebody, you know, you might make 1,000 LPs of something weird and then only, you know, sell 600, and then you're sitting on your stock, and it just kind of drips along after that first couple of months when you get your press bang. So you're not getting all your money back, and it's difficult, you know, sometimes when you're dealing with little projects like this and trying to calibrate, okay, like, you know, how many should I make? How many can I sell in the first couple of months? Because that's realistically the window where you're going to do most of your business.
Sure.
So, you know, that's definitely hard. But you also have the CD waning, obviously. You have the MP3, which is ready to die. I don't know who is downloading an MP3 these days. I mean, people are, believe it or not, but I can't see that continuing for much longer. Streaming is wonderful. I love it as a consumer. And the revenue is definitely growing. But if you're just selling some vinyl and that plus the revenue from the streaming together, like, you have to have a lot of things cooking for that to work.
And you guys average about how many releases a year?
We've done probably about, I don't know, we've put out over 100 records now in 10 years, so about 10 a year. Yeah,
amazing.
Something like that. It feels like a small number to me, because the labels that I really admire from the past, like Folkways or Rounder or Yazoo or something, they were just like constantly pumping out like 100 records a year, you know, like, I want to be like that. I want to do that. But they don't have time or resources, and it's only me.
Yeah.
I guess those companies had like armies of people like churning out records. But
they might have had a few employees during their heyday.
Yeah, I think so.
So let's talk about the main reason I wanted to talk to you is, you know, you could have opened a fancy bottle of champagne or something, but instead, to celebrate your 10th anniversary, you had a guitar built.
Right. So, yeah, I just thought that it would be cool to make a Tompkins Square model guitar. So we approached this luthier in Western Mass. He's based in East Hampton, and his name is Trevor Healy of Healy Guitars. And, you know, went to him without really any idea. I mean, I don't know about guitars that much, so I just said, like, you know, gave him the reins in terms of the creativity and the design and everything else. And he made this beautiful guitar, and I spent the last summer a few weeks running around East Coast with my kids, and we recorded some of them and made a video of everyone, like, sort of blessing the guitar. And I suppose if anybody would want a custom-made Tompkins Square guitar, they can get one from Healy Guitars.
Well, you've got a story about Trevor in an upcoming issue, because he's been doing these Bay State guitar recreations. But how did you originally find him?
Oh, I found him because he actually appears on one of my records, which is called Beyond Berkeley Guitar.
Okay.
And we did two compilations of guitarists from the Bay Area, young guitarists. And that's how I came to know him. And then he moved. So he used to be based out here in the Bay Area, and now he's based in Massachusetts.
And what, you know, I know you said you kind of let him have free rein, but was the thinking, I want to make the ultimate guitar for this style of playing?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think I've heard a lot of people play the guitar, and it sounds incredible. But I don't know if that, you'd have to ask him more like what he was thinking in terms of the design versus like the sound versus what Tompkins Square is known for.
Got it. And what, let's talk about this road trip, which you took with your daughters, which is awesome. And we've got video of that on our site, but, what, had you met all these people before this sort of road trip?
Yeah, it's basically, I think there's 10 or 11 guitar players. I felt really bad because we had Trevor, you know, Trevor's a tremendous musician, and we had him playing, and it was the first one that I did, and I have no technical skills with the camera or the audio. I got one of these little Zooms that I, you know, used. And so technically, like, the video ain't that hot, or I should say isn't as good as, like, if someone who knew what they were doing was making it. Mm-hmm. But with that said, like, my daughter shot a lot of it. You know, she's 14. She did a much better job than I did. But, you know, basically it's artists who are associated with Tompkins Square, have recorded for Tompkins Square. And of course, like, we've had relationships with those folks, like William Tyler and Don Bykoff and Max Oakes and Harry Tauzig and, you know, William Tyler. I said him already. Yeah, a whole bunch of people on there. And it was so much fun, you know, just, you know, it was a cool project just to get around and do that. And one of the cool things that I did was I went to visit Peter Walker, and he has Karen Dalton's guitar.
Okay.
Which is a Gibson J45. And I played that guitar, and it was the best sounding guitar I've ever played. I don't know if it was just like the magic of holding Karen Dalton's guitar, but it was incredible. It just sounded so good.
Amazing. So you recorded, you know, you'd basically go to each of these guys' homes and spend an afternoon and get a song or two out of them?
Yeah, it was in different spots. Like, you had to catch his catch can. Like, you know, there was Nathan Salzberg was backstage, you know, doing a show with Joan Shelley. So I snagged him, and, you know, all different places, people's backyards, you know, different spots. We did William Tyler's out at the Wilco Festival in Massachusetts. That was really fun.
Well, it's an amazing project. I, of course, like everyone, watched it and thought, I want to hear the whole song. You know?
I know. Well, you know, we didn't, I guess, you know, I could have made a video where there's just like complete performances by everyone, but, you know, and maybe I should have, but it's just, that would have been like an hour or two. And I just feel like people's attention spans are really short. And it, to be honest, like, I wanted it to come out last year, which was, you know, in tandem with the anniversary, the 10th anniversary. And now it's like the 10th anniversary is kind of old news. But it was just going to be like a little commercial for the label for the 10th anniversary. But, you know, it is what it is. It's a lovely thing. I hope people enjoy it, and maybe it'll turn some folks on to some of these guitarists that they've never heard before.
Well, I know, and I have all these recordings, and it reminded me to go back and check some of them out again, because it is remarkably timeless and amazing music that some of these under the radar guys have made. It's just incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really looking forward to some of the stuff. Like Don Bykoff is going to do Hopscotch this year. He was offered a slot on there. I mean, some of these guys are starting to get more recognized, which is really great. Richard Osborne is making a record for Tompkins Square, and he's actually going to use the Tompkins Square guitar on his record.
That's amazing.
Which would be pretty neat. And if you're not familiar with him, he is from the Basho School. He studied with Robbie Basho and is really one of the last guys, you know, who can say anything like that. You know, where, you know, that generation is, you know, is getting on in years. Most of the relevant guys from that generation who are from this so-called school, you know, are somehow associated with Tompkins Square, like Peter and Max and Harry Tausig, and Osborne is definitely in that club. Although the difference is he didn't record during that era. He started recording in, you know, the 90s or 2000s even.
Well, I am always in awe of you for the guys that you are able to uncover. And every time I get an envelope from you guys, there's always really amazing music in there. What's next for this guitar beyond the one recording project you just talked about?
Well, I mean, I don't want the guitar to sit in the closet. And I'm a kind of a lousy guitar player. So this is an open call and invitation that if somebody wants to come to the Bay Area and they want to borrow the guitar, they may do so. And, you know, I want it to get used. I mean, I think Chuck Johnson's probably going to play around with it. You know, as I said, Richard's recording with it, and people are welcome to use the guitar, record with it, do whatever they want, except hawk it.
Very cool.
We don't want any of that.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for talking. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and keep up the good work.
And thank you so much.